I want to talk about two cultures. Actually, I want to talk about three sets of two cultures. Same cultures three times over. First, think about the difference between the culture surrounding text and the culture surrounding film. For those of us who live with texts, we know texts to be a free culture. We feel free to write, to quote, to cite, without ever imagining we would have to ask anyone for permission to engage in these rights. Without permission, we produce, we use other people's words, their ideas, their reputation to advance our own ideas. For example, this man, a good friend of mine, Stephen Manis, who writes a column self-identified as Digital Tool for a magazine self-identified as Capitalist Tool, wrote a review of my latest book, Free Culture. I can summarize the review in one word. He thought my book was idiotic. He thought it should be retitled Free Loading Culture, and he proceeded to blather on for words and hundreds of words upon hundreds of words about how idiotic the book was. But the point is, he was free to use my words, to write this review, to use my reputation however he wanted, even if he wanted to destroy it. He was free to engage in that act of speech because this culture protects the right to use other people's words without permission. This culture is free. Now compare it to the film culture. Film lives in a totally different universe. It's not free in this sense. If you want to use clips or images and art in the context of making a film, you require permission first. You have to clear those rights with the owners of that culture. Now, only if, what does that mean? Well, it means that if you want to produce the film and you don't have permission for every bit of art or every clip or images used within the film, then that means you will not get insurance to distribute the film, which means that no one will permit the film to be distributed in the ordinary channels of distribution, which means without permission, you are sent to oblivion. So you live in a world as a filmmaker where if you want your work to be spread broadly and allow your creativity to be known, you must get permission first and produce with the constraints of those permissions. For example, let's say you wanted to make a film about this most evil network called Fox. A network which calls itself fair and balanced, but the real way to understand that is, quote, fair and balanced. A network which is a perversion of the very idea of news network. Now imagine you wanted to make a movie demonstrating just how perverse this network was. Well, to do that in a way that could be distributed generally, you would have to use clips from Fox Network. Well, to use clips in the world of film from Fox Network, you can only do it with permission of Fox. So what's the likelihood of getting permission from Fox to make a film criticizing Fox about the unfair and unbalanced way in which they report the news? We have a saying in the States. When hell freezes over, you will get permission from Fox to make this film. This world of film is not, in this sense, free. Okay, that's the first culture. Here's another two cultures. The world of IP versus IP. Right, the world of internet protocol versus the world of intellectual property. Right, so culture one, internet protocol. The world of internet protocol, digital technologies, and the IP that makes it sing, the internet age, is a world where everything is presumed to be copyable. It is the architecture, the essence of the architecture, that the content that's on this network is reproduced and linked. The ideal of being able to link and to reproduce is the norm in this space. It is the ideal that spreads the most efficient network the world has seen, that this freedom is guaranteed. So, for example, you know, you go to any ordinary web page, you can open up the source code to that web page, you can take that source code and do with it as you wish. This is how all of us learned HTML. I'm sorry, Tim O'Reilly, we bought your books after we learned HTML. This is the way you learn in a culture that is free, by copying and changing and transforming in the process of understanding what the world is. That's a free culture. Compare it to the world of intellectual property, which in the digital age is not free. That's very different from the way it was in the analog age. In the analog age, I want to submit, intellectual property did produce a free culture. The uses, ordinary uses of creative work in the analog age were essentially free, right? Think about the way the law regulates here. Intellectual property regulates in the context of copyright by regulating copies. So think about the analog world. If these are all the possible uses, for example, of a book, a whole bunch of these uses are just unregulated by the law. For example, reading a book doesn't produce a copy, therefore is unregulated by the law. Giving somebody a book doesn't produce a copy, therefore is unregulated by the law. Selling a book is explicitly in the United States exempted from the regulation of copyright law. Sleeping on a book does not produce a copy. It is unregulated by the law. These uses of this cultural content are outside of the reach of copyright. And then that the core of the possible uses of this creative work are a set of uses which are, in my view, properly regulated. For example, to republish the book requires the permission of the copyright owner because it's properly within the scope of what copyright regulates. And then within the American tradition, we have a thin sliver of exceptions, which we call fair uses. Uses which otherwise would be regulated by the law because they are uses that produce a copy, but which the law says people ought to have the right to engage in whether the content owner says so or not. So Stephen Manus can write a review that calls my book idiotic, whether I give him permission or not, even if he uses my words in making that review. He's free to do that because the law of fair use says he can. But in the world of digital content, these norms change. And the intellectual property in the digital age, a very important difference is introduced almost by technical accident. If the law regulates copies, and if it's the architecture of a digital network such that everything you do produces a copy, then the mindless lawyer reaction to this fact is to say, all unregulated uses disappear. Presumptively, everything is regulated in a world where everything produces a copy. To read a book is to produce a copy, and therefore to read a book produces a regulated use in the world of digital content. The unregulated disappears and the default of regulation expands broadly. To copy requires permission and therefore produces a different culture, a permission culture, where to use or recreate or criticize or to build upon in the digital context requires the permission of someone else. So for example, 1993, a guy named Alex Albin worked for a company called Starwave. They were investigating new CD-ROM technologies, ways to use CD-ROMs to spread culture. They wanted to make a CD-ROM retrospective on Clint Eastwood's career. Clint had participated in over 50 films. That's my kid. He's allowed to cry. It's all right. 50 films in his career. And these 50 films, they wanted to put on this CD-ROM in little clips in ways that would make it so you could understand how Clint's career grew. So they talked to Clint. Clint was wildly in favor of the idea, so they began to think about how they'd go about doing the project. And of course, to do it in the context of film, you need permissions for everything you're going to do, right? So they were thinking about the permissions from actors, for the display rights, derivative rights, images, etc. It was a nightmare for any ordinary lawyer. But Alex wasn't an ordinary lawyer. He presented to his boss how he would do it, and his boss said, go for it. So Alex put together a team, and they broke up all of the rights, and they gathered together a gaggle of lawyers who went out and cleared the rights for this one CD-ROM that had clips from 50 of Clint Eastwood's films. And they succeeded. 1 year later, they succeeded. took a year's worth of 12 lawyers to go together to clear the rights to produce this one CD-ROM because the regime is so extraordinarily burdensome and expensive that this is what's required to release this content. This content, this world, this culture is not free. It is a permission culture. Okay, final brace of cultures. Think about the contrast between 20th century culture and 21st century culture. And here, to understand 20th century culture, we just need one picture. 20th century culture is the couch potato culture. It is a culture that has experienced culture as fed to it, broadcast to it, the few broadcasting to the many. In this culture, we have a difference between consumers of culture and the producers of culture. We have a good in this culture, which is channels, and better in this culture is just more channels. Our ideal is an infinite number of channels. They sit there with potato chips and consume. Right? That's what 20th century culture is like. And the producers in this world produce something that's called, quote, property, and we buy it. And when we don't buy it, when we steal it, as they say, they send their police officers after us. Now compare that culture to what I think we should recognize as 21st century culture. And here we have to play a little game of ageism. We have to distinguish between us and them. And I'm trying to come to terms with thinking of myself as us in the sense of old. So here I'm going to do this. This is an exercise many of you should practice. Here we are, old people, and we have to distinguish between the way we think about culture and the way our kids will think about culture. We think about culture as something consumed. They will think about culture as something they consume and create. We think about culture as something we take. They will think about culture as something that they make, and then they remake, and then they remix, and then they remake and share with their friends. That's their idea of what they do with culture, and we know that because when we watch kids between the age of 5 and 7, using computers, this is the natural way in which they think computers ought to be used, to take sounds and images from around them and remake them, re-express them, and share them with others. So, for example, here are some trivial, in some sense, examples of what this remix culture will look like. This is a video made by members of this culture trying to explain what they are seeking. It's the beginning of the video, but I want you to see three important ways they describe it.
The song could be between two of your favorites. In the middle of the B-side of your mixtape. You got it off of the web, burned it onto a disc. Bounced it on a cassette, cause it's an old rock. Mixtape, on your mixtape.
Okay, three ideas they think of as revolutionary, right? One idea is, what if creative works were building blocks? Now, there's an extraordinary perversion in that question, right? Because, of course, creative works have always been building blocks, but they frame it as revolutionary because they are distinguishing the way they want to understand culture from the way their parents understood culture, or ingredients that could be used by others. Then art becomes organic. This is the ideal. Art, which is building blocks that others get to use to produce an organic relationship to art, that's what this generation imagines culture could be. So some examples.
One, two, three, go! My baby don't mess around because she loves me so.
Remix culture. Here's remix culture in music. You know, the Beatles made this album. Jay-Z made that album. That inspired DJ Danger Mouse, of course, to make the Grey album. The mixture, synthesis between the white and the black album, right? And it's not just DJ Danger Mouse.
May I have your attention, please? May I have your attention, please? Will the real Slim Shady please stand up? I repeat, will the real Slim Shady please stand up?
Will Smith still got a cousin his brand
so. Or...
Yo, Chuck, these honey drippers are still front on us. Show them that we can do this, because we always do this. Ha ha, yeah, boy.
How low can Here's film, right? 2004, this guy made a film called Tarnation. It was a rage at Cannes. Cost $218 to make this film. That was the cost of videotape, and he had to buy some angel wings. That was a really expensive part to the film. This is digital culture. For $218, you can make a film that captures the attention of Cannes. Most important in the United States right now, though, are the series of this remix culture that is political, that's expressing political ideas.
Do you ever get the feeling you are living in a virtual reality dream world, fabricated to enslave your mind?
A live all-war edition of American Juniors.
But there is another sound, the sound of goodwill.
Oh, sorry, there. I'm far away in a remote place, and we get these things secondhand.
Open debate between the President of the United States and the one man we believe has the insight and the cojones to stand up to him. So first, joining us tonight, George W. Bush, 43rd President of the United States. Welcome, Mr. President.
Good evening. I'm pleased to take your questions tonight.
Well, thank you very much, sir. I'm pleased to ask. Taking the other side, joining us from the year 2000, Texas Governor and presidential candidate, George W. Bush.
Good evening.
Thank you, Governor. Mr. President, you won the coin toss. The first question will go to you. Why is the United States of America using its power to change governments in foreign countries?
We must stand up for our security and for the permanent rights and the hopes of mankind. The United States of America will make that stand.
Well, certainly that represents a bold new doctrine in foreign policy, Mr. President. Governor Bush, do you agree with that?
Yeah, I'm not so sure the world of the United States is going around the world and say this is the way it's got to be.
Well, not to think that remix culture is any political bias, here's...
Massachusetts Senator John Kerry. Hairstyle by Christoph's, $75. Designer shirts, $250. 42-foot luxury yacht, $1 million. Four lavish mansions and beachfront estate, over $30 million. Another rich liberal elitist from Massachusetts who claims he's a man of the people. Priceless.
And my favorite example.
Be-minded. my love, there's only you in my life, the only thing that's right.
My first love, your every breath that I take, your every step I make.
The 21st century conception of creativity. These are trivial examples, but they say something about a potential which Apple used to call the potential to rip, mix, and burn culture until Disney told them to stop using that slogan, a potential for a kind of creativity, digital technology enabling creativity, changing both artist and consumer, bringing the consumer, the audience, on stage with the artist, changing the way we mix or remix culture, and changing creative and, most importantly, democratic potential. Because think of what this represents. With the $2,000 machine, anybody can take images and sounds and text from their culture and remix them and spread them on a free network in a way that has more power in its message than anything could have prior to this emergence of a technology, changing the freedom to speak, changing the power to speak, as we produce a different kind of democracy, not the broadcast democracy, but a bottom-up democracy, not the New York Times democracy, but a blog democracy, not the few blathering to the many, my boy and I blathering to you, but peer-to-peer. This is the potential that this culture could produce, this 21st century culture could produce, if they are allowed. But of course, each of the examples I showed you tonight are illegal under the laws as they exist right now. There is no right to remix in this way without permission first. These are restricted, illegal art because the laws of copyright deem them to be outside of the freedoms that otherwise would be. This culture that could do this would be a free culture. It depends upon a free culture for that creativity to be allowed. These are two cultures. These are three sets of two cultures. They are colliding right now. I can prove it. Watch. See? They just collided. Three sets of two cultures that are increasingly taking a freedom that lived in the context of text and in the context of IP and in the ideals of a 21st century culture could be, these ideals are now threatened by the control increasingly exerted by those who come from the film culture, the IP culture, those who come from the 20th century. This system of control, of permission, is prevailing in this battle. It's prevailing, forcing the regime of freedoms that the law could be to give up the free culture and embrace the control, because we are waging a war. Actually, of course, we wage many wars in the United States, but the one I want to focus on is this copyright war. A war against something called piracy, a war which my friend Jack Valenti calls his own terrorist war, where the terrorists are our children. This is a war being waged to rally the most powerful in my society against this freedom to, quote, copy. But the consequence of waging that war, the very same weapons that will be used in that war, will be used to destroy this potential for a free culture. Winning that war means destroying the opportunity for the free culture of the 21st century to be realized, transforming this free culture into the permission culture that we now know. Now, how is this done, or why is this done? Well, I think it's extraordinarily appropriate for us to have this conversation sitting here in Alexanderplatz, right? Because we, too, have lived 80 years of Soviet culture. Not Soviet in the same sense, but 80 years where we can't imagine the idea of creativity, of culture being produced except by the few to the many. We can't imagine that. We, from the 20th century, can't imagine that. And we only know the idea of culture being consumed like this. And so when the peer-to-peer ideal becomes the reality that people describe in debates in Washington and around the world, we transform that freedom into criminal acts. We demand regulation of that. We enforce control. We require permission everywhere. To engage in the act of creating and remixing requires permission. And even people like this believe this system of permission is just simple. Stephen Maness, in his review, said, "What's his problem? It's simple. Just ask permission first." Right? Permission culture is simple. Now, the appropriate legal response to that statement is this. Right? What the hell are you talking about? It's simple. Because sometimes, of course, these freedoms are expensive to buy. That's what permission means, how you buy. For example, this film that cost $218, if you read the rest of the article, you'll see it says, "The total spent will rise to about $400,000, he said, once rights for music and video clips he used to illustrate a mood or an era have been paid for." Sometimes these permissions are just denied. So in this favorite example from Read My Lips, you want to see how weird lawyers are. This amazing company from Sweden, Atmo.se is the company, went to Columbia, the owners of the rights, to get permission to sync that music, Endless Love, with those images. Now, whatever you think about the president, whatever you think about Tony Blair, whatever you think about the war, there's one thing it's impossible to think. It's impossible to think what they said the reason was why they would not give permission. It's not funny, they said. So sometimes it's too expensive, sometimes it's just denied, sometimes it's just insanely complex. So for example, 1930 in the United States, 10,057 books published. 2001, 174 of those books are still in print, 9,883 out of print. So an entrepreneur, Brewster Kahle, decides he wants to take out-of-print books, scan them, make them available for free on the internet, not just from 1930, but for every year he can do, spreading culture widely, cheaply, building an Library of Alexandria you don't have to cross a desert to get to anybody with connection to a computer. Well, how would you do this? He asked his lawyers. And his lawyers said, well, we have to, first of all, figure out which of the 9,883 books are still under copyright. To do that, you have to go through these tomes of text and copy page by page to see which might still be under copyright, because presumptively, they still are under copyright, because Congress in 1998 passed the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act, which extended the term of copyright for 20 more years. So first, you have to segment out copyrighted from uncopyrighted, and then for the copyrighted works, you've got to ask permission first. Well, sane people think there must be a simple way to do that. There must be a simple way. It must be a list somewhere, right? Some registry the government keeps. I mean, it is, after all, monopolies the government is giving away. We must be able to find out who owns them. But of course, there is no list. You want to find out who owns the 9,883 copyrights to be able to release these out-of-print books on the internet. You literally have to hire a private detective to track these people down. And the point is, if you have to hire a private detective for 9,000 books in 1930 and 1931 and 1932, nobody can afford to do it. Call it property all you want. The point is, this property is unusable because it sits under a burden of insanely complex legal regulation, which makes it impossible for it to be reused in any effective way. This radical change in the way copyright law regulates our society is the product of this war against, quote, copying. And so when the law regulates now, more harshly, more extensively, more inefficiently than it ever has in our past, there is a fact which those of us who pride ourselves from coming from a free society find hard to admit. That is, that never in our history have fewer exercised more legal control over culture than now. Never has the extent of regulation been as powerful or as concentrated. There has never been a time society could have looked at such a problem and produced so much control over how we produce and recreate our culture. So when you say it's simple, Stephen Manus, you have in mind this. It's a simple system if all you want to be is a couch potato. But if you imagine the creativity that produced this or the creativity that our children will feel in their blood, then to say it's simple is just simply idiotic. This war, like all wars, has costs. Some are direct, some are collateral. The direct costs are to progress, to learning, to economic growth. Because, of course, if there were a free culture that people could remix and spread, and companies like Apple and Intel and Red Hat would make an extraordinary amount of money off of the growth that economy would produce. But the collateral damage is the one which I, as a law professor, struggle with more strongly. We have a generation that grows up believing that violating law is the right thing to do. Again, here we are in Alexanderplatz, and we are connecting with the black market generation. A generation that grew up believing that violating the rule imposed on them was the right and appropriate way to respond. Our children, 40 million of them in the United States, systematically engage in behavior which violates the law. They call them terrorists. They begin to think of themselves as terrorists. This produces extremes within the culture, right? So they sue 12-year-olds, and the 12-year-olds respond with, "I reject any rule at all. No rule makes sense." Right? This is captured in this wonderful brace of advertisements. Apple and Pepsi thought they'd get together, capture the real spirit of the file-sharing generation. Here's the ad they produced. Breaking rocks in the hot sun. I fought the law and the law won. I fought the law and the law won. Hi, I'm one of the kids who was prosecuted for downloading music free off of the internet. And I'm here to announce in front of everyone, we're still going to download music free off of the internet. I fought the law and the law won. I fought the law and the law won. I fought the law and the law won. I fought the law and the... And there's not a thing anyone can do about it. So you can imagine the ad execs who are so proud at themselves that they had captured the spirit of the file-sharing generation, which is to be able to get music for free as long as you were drinking a Pepsi at the same time. Right? That produced this ad in a very short order in response. What is this extremism? Begets a certain extremism in response. Ideas like the rule of law mean to a whole generation just simply unjust rule. And yet their response, the content industry's response to this extremism, is like the United States' response in Iraq, to wage an ever more vicious war to pacify the enemy. to increase the felony prosecutions, to increase the number of felonies so that we can drive this criminal element out. But that's an insane response. It's an insane response to the digital age. Our response should be to find a way to wage peace here, to fit this law to a technology which liberates an extraordinary range of creators in a way we have never before seen. So here's one idea. We launched about a year and a half ago this project called Creative Commons. Its simple idea was, let's find a simple way to mark content with freedoms that the author intends that content to carry. You can go to our site, you get to choose a license, giving you options of requiring attribution, permitting commercial use, allowing modifications, imposing a copyleft share-alike requirement on modifications. That gives you a three-layered license. One layer is a human-readable commons deed. It says what freedoms you have associated with this content. Then there's a very different lawyer-readable license, a billion-page document that is written by some of the best lawyers in Silicon Valley, from Wilson Sonsini and Cooley Godward. And then most important to me is a machine-readable layer that embeds in a way computers can understand the meaning of the freedoms associated with that license. These three go together so that we can imagine search engines, for example, saying, show me all the pictures of the Empire State Building available for non-commercial use, and you begin to gather content on the basis of the freedoms. So, for example, this is a song written by Colin Mutchler, a guitar track, which he donated to a site called OpSound and named it My Life, made available under a Creative Commons license, as all OpSound sound resources are. A girl, 17-year-old violinist Cora Beth, took that song, added the violin track you hear on top of it, and re-released it to the net, My Life Changed. Now, the part that lawyers find hard to understand in this story is there was no lawyer standing between these two creators. This creativity was allowed because the freedoms were marked in content and they respected the freedoms as content marked. And it's this kind of creativity that this project is aiming to spread. Now, the key fact here is that this is voluntary. It is artists choosing to make their work available in this way, and it feeds this ideal of free culture to the extent there is more and more of this content out there that people can build upon. So in the first year, we recorded 1 million link backs to our licenses on the web, and within 3 more months, that number had gone up to 3 million, an increasing growth rate in just the first 14 months. And most important, last year, we launched a project which Christiana is managing here in Berlin, the iCommons project, to carry this to as many countries around the world as we can by taking the legal code and porting it to different legal jurisdictions. And so that ported code, which of course is much like taking code written for the Windows operating system and making it run in a Mac operating system environment, is a very complicated and involved project, but the ideal is that we will have a common standard around the world for expressing freedom associated with content. Already 60 countries have begun participating in this project, and we've had 4 countries launch, and today, of course, we're launching Germany. So now, if from Germany you come to the website and you seek to make a license, you will find your options offered to you in German, and we will produce a German commons deed and a license that has been ported to the German legal system in a process that will be described at the after I've finished this talk. Now, this is just one idea. It's one way to resist this spread of this permission culture. It is inspired, of course, by the Free Software Foundation, for it uses the same technique that Stallman's copyleft ideal launched in 1984. You build freedom on top of a system of copyright. You use the property right of copyright to embed the freedoms with the content that guarantees that others can build on that freedom. And the aim is to flood the world with this content, content that announces its freedom, carries it with it as it spreads across the net, and to fuel in this process this free culture. Now, this is a battle that has a certain urgency to it. Because I've been complaining so far about the restrictions that laws impose. And right now, the restrictions on free culture are essentially restrictions that law imposes. But the real threat to free culture is the restrictions that are being embedded in the very infrastructure of the network to enable digital rights management technologies to deliver the precise control that the 20th century ideal of culture wants, using code to decide how content gets used. So now when you decide to disobey the rule, you're disobeying a rule imposed by law and you might or might not get restricted. This is making it not just illegal. In the future, it will, for most, be impossible to engage in this act of creative remixing of our culture. There is an urgent need now to spread in this culture a different idea, an idea that says giving anyone this power over the opportunity to build and transform is a mistake. Giving anybody that power is idiotic, you might say. Or if you read the history, you could get worked up enough to say it's outrageous because it totally inverts a tradition of freedom. But whether it's idiotic or outrageous, we have to recognize this threat is a real threat to the opportunity of our cultures to aspire to these ideals of freedom. And it is following the path that the Free Software Foundation launched that we want Creative Commons to extend that ideal to the widest range of cultures so that the choice is not black and white between handing over our freedom to remake a culture to the few or abolishing the idea of copyright. Instead, the choice is the balanced free culture that has been our past and yet will be taken from us if this infrastructure of control is built into the network that was born free. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. If there are any questions for Professor Lessig, please feel free to ask them now.
Hello. I have a question on how this internationalization of Creative Commons works. Say I release a work under a Creative Commons license in Brazil and somebody in Germany is using it. Have I released it under the Brazilian legal system and somebody's going to use it under the German one? How does that work?
So the ideal of the licenses is that they're all are universal or international. But that ideal in practice turns out to be more an ideal than reality. So in principle, that license should be totally enforceable in any of the countries that sign on to the intellectual property treaties. But we've localized it in many countries to make sure that any peculiarities with that country get reflected in the license, and also to make it an international process, right? We didn't want to produce one license that purported to speak internationally, but we had to fit a bunch of different licenses and create these local organizations that wanted to support it. So I think the German license will see some of the restrictions that were required in that that aren't necessarily in other licenses, but that's the same decision that happens at each decision.
All the licenses you've talked about so far are based on copyright. If you want to extend this sort of idea to different areas, such as science, in the case of the Human Genome Project, you can't copyright DNA, so we try doing things with click wrap, but they end up being so complicated, they actually make it hard to use the data.
Right.
So you're starting something for science. How do you see this problem of law getting in the way?
Yeah, so we've gotten funding to launch a Science Commons project. Science Commons project is infinitely more complicated. One part of it's relatively easy, the kind of open access publishing problem. So we use Creative Commons licenses in the context of Biomed Central or Public Library of Science. They release their articles under Creative Commons licenses to guarantee free access forever with those. But in addition to copyright, there's patent problems, which we are dealing with by creating these kind of truces among different patent holders in certain areas of research. And in the area of data, the really hard question is whether we want to recognize any intellectual property right there at all. Europeans believe there is such a thing as intellectual property in data. IP Americans believe there isn't, right? So the easiest thing we're going to do in the context of data is set up funding models that funding agencies can adopt so that they require that any data produced using their money be turned over in a way that makes it accessible to people in a general way. All three of those are hacks on a poorly crafted system for dealing with intellectual property in the context of science. And that's because I don't think IP was ever intended to deal with something like science. So we're, again, trying to find an easy way to remove the law, the burden of the law, from doing what scientists are supposed to be doing.
Question here. What are the chances that the big boys are going to take you up on your copyright, on your Creative Commons license? What proportion of the illegal downloads and bootleg will become legal if you make it possible for people to do this?
Well, that's a really hard question. I think the key to the success of this project is in the next 2 years, its primary measure of success will be the internationalization project. We just came from Brazil, where Brazil announced the Creative Commons licenses, and the culture minister, Gilberto Gil, who's also one of Brazil's greatest musicians, released a song of his under a Creative Commons license that he inspired called the Recombo license that allows people to remix music, even for commercial purposes. And he gave a concert sort of celebrating the ideal of Creative Commons coming to Brazil. And the point that was really obvious in that context was that to the extent this spreads in other cultures broadly and quickly, then I think it becomes a standard, a simple way to express something different from the extremism that I think the American debate frames it as. And if in the next 2 years we succeed, or actually it's all your doing, if Christiana succeeds in the next 2 years, it's all up to her right now, in getting 60 or 100 countries up in this project and changing 3 million link backs to 100 million link backs, then this seeps into the culture. That's the point. More and more people begin to think about what is this issue about. They begin to see a spectrum of rights, a spectrum of freedoms being associated with content. And they begin to reject the sort of simple model of Hollywood, which says that we have to keep all rights forever, otherwise anarchy reigns. The problem is that idea has to come from outside the United States and teach the United States again something about the importance in balance and limits in intellectual property. Because that was our tradition before just 30 years ago, right? We were, our first 100 years, we didn't protect foreign copyrights at all. We were born a pirate nation, right? That's the way we thought developing nations should develop, right? Steal other people's ideas and then spread them. But we have forgotten these ideals of balance, and I think only when countries like Brazil and countries in Europe and countries like Japan, which was the first to adopt this license, begin to demonstrate its importance, will it have an effect on the debate in a way that I think will change the extremism of the current debate.
Hi, I'm Sunir Shah. I'm a master's student at U of T, and I'm studying these kind of issues. And I've also been using computers since I was like 4. And I was so glad that it's Control C and Control V was within the span of my four-year-old hand, because I've been doing it forever. And then I remember, though, when I was getting into teenage years and the GPL had come out, we were quite happily exchanging code and ideas without even thinking about copyright. And then this GPL hit the scene, and it was more like a mind virus than a copyleft virus, because everyone started talking about copyright all of a sudden. And now I live in the age where I can't even, you know, publish a paragraph without people arguing with me about the license for that. And I was always like, you know, please plagiarize, don't pirate, you know, take whatever you want, but don't take everything, right? Because my career depends on me owning this particular thing I'm publishing. But now I'm looking at these licenses, and it's not like that. I'm not likely that the person on OpSound published the guitar rip was going to sue the person who took it and put a violin on it. The license doesn't seem to be more indemnifying than against lawsuits from outside. But, you know, the corporations are not going to use these samples either. But I see now that the GPL ran for 12 years until it got tested in court finally. Do you find that as a philosophical tool, it was successful? Now it's going to be interacting with the corporate world and getting into lawsuits. Do you find it's going to be more about breaking the law, breaking the legal structure rather than breaking the mental structure? And do you think that's going to actually impact how successful it's going to be? Maybe it's going to fail. Maybe it's not going to be so successful as a philosophical tool anymore.
Oh, I think it was a brilliant philosophical tool. I still do, and I'm happy to copy it and try to extend it into the context of culture. It was brilliant because it broke down a distinction that people had assumed but had no basis. The distinction was that commercial world only exists on top of property, and the non-commercial world exists on top of no property, right? But commercial success depends as much upon open and free resources as non-commercial world does. Everybody depends on this balance. So I thought it was a brilliant move in the philosophical space in the free software movement. The same thing's happening in the free culture space. People have to begin to recognize that there's something deeply ironic, you could say unjust, but let's stop with irony here, about a company like Disney, whose whole career was made taking other people's creativity and remixing it and releasing it, right? The Brothers Grimm all the way up to the embarrassment Treasure Planet released 2 years ago, right? This is a career that's built upon remixing other people's culture, and then for them to become the stalwarts of nobody will ever be able to do to Disney what Disney did to the Brothers Grimm is, I think, the kind of confusion that this has got to break. So we really fundamentally believe that to the extent people recognize how free culture contributes to, you know, commercial as well as non-commercial creativity, that will help us resist the extremism of the current debate.
David Bovell here from London. I was at your talk in London where you highlighted the importance of the BBC Creative Archive project. I've just come back from Sweden as well, where they have a similar public-funded broadcast network, and I'm wondering if you could comment on that project and if you've had any discussions or any news on this important project in this context.
I don't know much about the Swedish project. I do know a lot about the British project. So BBC is going to release an increasing amount of their archive content under a license very similar to Creative Commons licenses to enable British citizens to remix British BBC culture, right? And the greatest thing about that is it's the first example that everybody gets the first time you describe it. They all see how valuable and important it is to not just, you know, the kids that will be able to do whatever they want with this content, but to computer manufacturers, to chip manufacturers, to people selling broadband, to people selling software. All of these people will benefit from a world where people, you know, now find it cool to remix content and share it and be able to do it legally without fearing criminal prosecution. And that will, I think, measure how valuable this can be to the economy. And my hope is you know, as other countries look at Britain, and I guess Sweden too, and see how this freedom is spurring lots of follow-on benefits in the society, they will adopt it as well. Now, of course, the other response is to demonize it. And that's, I'm sure, what most in the American copyright industry will do very quickly. And so it's a real test of whether it will succeed, because Americans' power to force the world to follow its vision of extremism here has proven unchecked so far. There's a kind of pathetic feature of the rest of the world, which is to bend to this exertion of American will, right? Some countries, like developing nations, can't do anything about it. America comes there and forces them to sign more restrictive treaties than the international treaties are required. And so you can't expect them to resist that, because it's the only way they get trade. But it's Europe that's really the place where the failure to resist is most to be criticized, right? Because, I mean, Europe, on the one hand, had the most successful resistance to the software patent debate of anywhere in the world, right? The Euro-Linux movement launched an extraordinary movement here, which at the country level was very successful in getting resistance to this. But it's the weird feature of what you call European democracy that the Democrats get overruled by the bureaucrats. And so even though there was this strong democratic movement against software patents, eventually it will be overturned by whom? I mean, I don't even know who these people really are, but it represents power removed from the democratic process. It's that feature that I think allows this extremism to continue, that we don't even have a democratic check here, and the one place that could afford to insist on it, and yet who hasn't so far.
This is a sign. Is there one more question?
Yeah. You showed a million licenses. I just wondered what the public's behavior had really been in terms of whether they chose the share alike clause or not.
It's great data. So the options that we gave initially said you can choose whether you want to require attribution or not, whether you want to permit commercial use or not, whether you want to allow derivative works uses or not, and if you allow derivative works, whether you want a copy left requirement. 98% of people said they wanted attribution, which meant version two, we've dropped that option, attribution's required. Two-thirds of people forbid commercial use of their work, two-thirds permitted derivative uses of the work, and of those who permitted derivative uses, about 55% imposed a copyleft requirement and 45% didn't. So that's, you know, now that's data supported by over 3 million licenses, which I think is the first time we have any real sense of what ordinary people would think about what's an appropriate way to deal with this.
Again, thank you very much.